Welcome to the Legal Moves Podcast. My name is Zachary Strebeck. I am your host for the show, and I'm also a California game lawyer. Today, my guest is another member of the team at Raw Fury. You may remember last episode, which featured David Martinez, their marketing guy. Today, I have Jonas Antonsen on to discuss more of the publishing side of things rather than just marketing. Welcome, Jonas.
Thank you. Great to be on the show. Just a little bit about me. I've been in the games industry for quite a while now. Originally, as a developer, I set up a development company almost in another lifetime, I think. grew that to around 60 people. That was in Iceland. I'm a native Icelander. And then through the years, I've done a lot of different things. I've been on the development side. I've founded and funded a couple of companies. I've been in sort of a consulting role for everything from other developers to publishers. Then I moved to Sweden, which is a whole nother story, I think. But I ended up in Stockholm, and here I ended up working for a while for a company called Paradox Interactive, mm-hmm. which is a publishing company, and from there, Raw Fury was set up in the beginning of this year. We have a different focus from Paradox. Obviously, we're more focused on maybe small indie titles. While they're best known for their big strategy titles.
Yeah. I was going to ask, will I be able to play these games without learning 3 hours of tutorials and all that, like Crusader
right.
Kings?
Right. Yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, the for me personally, like the games I tend to play, they fall into two types of categories. Well, I guess there are three, but mainly it's the big strategy titles. So, mm-hmm. so I'm a big, I've played way too much of Crusader Kings, and I still enjoy it, tremendously. And now, actually, my 11-year-old son is picking up both Crusader Kings and Europa Universalis. And,
awesome.
And I keep telling myself it's good for him because he's learning a lot of history and things like that, and hopefully that's true. And then, on the other end of the spectrum, I actually play a lot of indie games. So kind of the everything in between those two things has kind of fallen out over the last few years. So like the bigger AAA games, the first person shooters, which I actually was quite big on. So now I just play these grunt strategy games and then interesting indie titles, and that's it. So I guess my split personality shows in Paradox and then what we're doing with Raw Fury.
Very cool. Yeah. I guess that was one of my questions. Like what, is there a lot of influence from your time at Paradox that's going into Raw Fury in the games you're selecting? But yeah, the two that you have chosen so far that I've seen, seem pretty different from what I know Paradox for. Although Paradox has a wide variety of games, right?
Right.
So, I mean, what I know the most for is for the grand strategy games. But very cool. So you have a small. Well, okay. First, what convinced you to move from being an employee at these companies to starting your own publishing company?
I think the anomaly was for me being an employee somewhere, and that tells you something about Paradox that they convinced me they convinced me to stay there as an employee. That's something I haven't done for more than a decade. So that's kind of the odd one out. So going back into making something on my own is actually kind of the norm and feels more at home for me. I feel I'm back doing what I do best, which is building new things.
I understand. I mean, once I went entrepreneur, it's hard for me to imagine going back to being an employee.
Right.
There's just something to being in charge of everything. And you're making your own luck, right? You're making your own success. I don't know. It's like a drug. You really want to keep pushing.
Well, I've sometimes had the conversation with people that like I'm really just an adrenaline junkie, but I don't jump from airplanes with a parachute or, you know, right. I do this, right? Yes. But it, I think it's more or less equivalent of it. But, you know, it really gets your juices flowing, and
absolutely,
it's extremely exciting, and it's, you know, you bite your nails a lot while doing it, but it's definitely, it's fun. Yeah.
So you're launching your first game soon. I think when this comes out, it'll be just a few days before Kingdom comes out. I also played Cathy Rain at PAX Prime, and I think I was the first person to actually finish the demo, which was exciting. I don't know. I enjoyed that. Do you have any other unannounced games that you're working on? I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of how many things are in the works.
So, I mean, we're looking at a number of games, but we're a very small unit. We're at this point only three people, which of course means that our bandwidth is limited as well.
Absolutely.
But it also means, and that's very intentional, that we don't have a specific portfolio strategy. We don't have to fill a predetermined slate, or you know, we don't have to source an X number of games each quarter or each year. So we can actually take the time we feel we need to look, you know, find the next thing we want to help with. So we're doing these two now. We're helping out with Kingdom and Cathy, and then like I said, we're looking at a few other cases that are extremely interesting, but we haven't closed anything yet.
Okay.
But definitely, there are definitely some very interesting games in the pile we're going through.
Yeah, that's the best part about the indie development scene, right? Is that there's so much interesting stuff out there. So I can imagine that you
so
have
much talent, man.
Yeah, so much talent. Well, let's talk a little bit about how you choose these games. So what drew you to the two games that you're currently working on? So you have Kingdom and Cathy Rain.
Right. Well, I mean, I think so. For me personally, both of these games, though they're different in many ways. I mean, they're games that are in two very different genres.
Yeah.
But they do have something in common if you look closely enough. Both of them have a very, very specific, let's call it, emotional resonance or impact on the player. So as soon as you sit down and start playing, there's an immediate emotion that both of these games evoke. And that's kind of what we look for. We look for games that have that sort of resonance that you, as soon as you sit down, you get pulled in and there's some emotional impact going on. And that's actually, I think, the hallmark of great games is that they do affect you emotionally from the very beginning. You feel something. And both of these games actually play a lot with the sense of discovery and curiosity and surprise, actually. So even though they're on the surface very different, they actually do pull at some of the same emotions when you play them. And for me, that's very important for me personally. I think when I look at some of the most successful indie games over the last, let's say, 3 to 5 years, this is what they all do incredibly successfully. And that's kind of what we look for. And then when we find something one of us feels is interesting, we all talk about it, we all play it, and we kind of move ahead or have conversations with those that where all three of us look at something and go like, this is amazing. This has to get out there. And if we can help in any way, we should try to do it.
Well, it seems like an important part of that. You know, if you're going to dedicate so much of your time to getting this game out there, you have to have some emotional investment in it. Right. And
right.
You have to be excited about it.
Absolutely. And we don't believe in, like, you know, we don't believe in fillers or you know, signing games that are just there to be there, right? We wanna help developers and help teams that are making something that we feel is you know, just needs to be out there and needs to be discovered. Right?
Cool. So how did these two get discovered by you? Did they come to you and pitch it, or did you find them? Where did you find them?
Well, I mean, it's funny. All three of us have been doing this for quite a while, and we all have our reputations, and we know a lot of people and all of that. So most of the games we see come through that. So it's, you know, friends talking to friends, and essentially, you know, that network at work, I guess. So we haven't really actively gone out to seek out games and developers. You know, sometimes we see something cool somewhere and we send it an email, but that's in the minority of cases. It's usually like someone knows someone. And for example, I mean, Kingdom comes to us because it's being done by one of the guys making it is a dear friend of mine. And I had actually played the Flash original before I knew he was involved with this incredible remake of the game. And Kathy Rain comes in a similar fashion. It comes through Gordon and his friendship with the guy that's developing that game. And then it's just a matter of, like, you know, we sit down and we talk, and if everybody likes each other, and that's a big important thing,
yeah,
right?
Like, definitely.
Because our foundation here is like we've said we've actually passed on a few projects or a few games that we thought had incredible you know, potential, but we looked at the case and we just knew that, you know, we wouldn't be the right ones to help out, not because there was something wrong with the team. You know, the teams usually were excellent, but basically we had to be honest as well and say, are we the best guys to help with this game? And if the answer isn't a resounding yes, then we shouldn't go ahead. And the reason for that is, I mean, how we look at it, it's a collaboration. It's a tight relationship, and it has to be built on mutual trust and mutual benefit and everybody being basically in the same boat, right? So that's how it gets started. And it starts with just getting to know each other, having conversations, talking about not just the game, but, you know, life in general, right? The core beliefs, everything.
Right,
because you wanna make sure that you can build that brilliant relationship, and you know, to some extent it's even closer than, like, it really is a marriage. And on the other end you have guys that are making the magic, and magic is an incredibly delicate force, and the magic can go away if the relationship isn't healthy. The magic usually goes away, and that's what we want to make sure doesn't happen, because the incredibly creative guys on the other end are truly making something magical, and you want them to be able to do that all the way through, and you want to be able to make them feel good, healthy, you know, all of those things.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, most of the time I have clients who are working together and coming up with a contract at the beginning of their relationship. And if they don't start off with a great relationship, you know, things generally don't get better over the course of that period. They're only getting worse because things are getting stressful, and, you know, you can argue and all that. And that's why we try to build those things into a contract. But yeah, if the relationship isn't great up front, then you could have big problems. Absolutely. Well, so for developers out there who are looking to find a publisher, someone like you, or some other maybe lesser publisher, maybe do you have any tips on attracting the attention of a publisher, or just even contacting? How do you make that first contact with a publisher?
Right. Well, I mean, there are a number of ways. There's cold calling. There's using your network if you have it, which is probably one of the best ways. There are conferences. There are shows. where you can show your game off and all of that. But I think it's the most important thing here is that when you're on the development side, then again, like I did this for a long while, I saw a lot of all sorts of publishing contracts. Some of them were okay, others were very shitty, and some of the shitty ones I even signed, because that's what you have to do sometimes. But I think it's so important to just realize what your goal is, what you're going after, and try to find someone that kind of rhymes with what you're trying to achieve and do. And then, of course, you could talk about like contractual terms and all that, and how these work, yada yada yada. But you know, the basis is a strong relationship that you feel is built on trust, and that everybody is like has the same core understanding. Sometimes, you know, sometimes developers don't need a publisher or don't want a publisher, and that's fine as well. Mm-hmm. But you just need to you need to know what you want, right? And what you're willing to do to achieve that, and in what way. Finding a publisher, one of the things I've never boiled down how I feel about it is the whole like matchmaking thing where you maybe go to events or something like that, and because sometimes I feel it creates like a fundamental like imbalance into the whole mix where you're pitching your game to the publisher or a number of publishers, because it's the same as when you're raising money. It like, you know, that the relationship is kind of in the very beginning is that you need them and they're kind of shopping around for like, right. you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, there's a power imbalance, right?
There's a power imbalance, and that's I'm not a fan of that. I think I'm not sure that's necessarily the best basis for a long-term relationship. But I mean, there are those events, and I mean, there are people like me that still go to those events and don't have that mindset, I think. So maybe they're useful, maybe they're good as well. But I think the strongest one is leveraging your network, and even cold calling. Like if you think a publisher would be really well suited to what you're doing, and you think they have a good you feel that they rhyme well with where you want to end up and how they do things and all of that, then sending them an email. I mean, most of us are pretty friendly, I think.
Well, there's two ways to go with that. I mean, the game you're developing could fit right in with the similar games that publisher has already made. Or maybe I've had publishers who are specifically looking for something in a genre that they haven't done in order to sort of fill out their portfolio, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, right now you have a kingdom simulator type of game, right? And a point and click adventure, right? Are you looking to continue to branch out into different genres with each game, or do you want to stay, you know, do more point and click adventures or do more of the kingdom type of game?
We haven't really thought about it, and I know that's a strange answer. Mm-hmm. But the reason we haven't really thought about it is mainly because, I mean, when I talk about genres, you're essentially they're just the type of label, and they're usually tied to the mechanics of the game, right? Mm-hmm. So when you nail down a genre, you're more or less talking about the mechanics of a game. The mechanics are, of course, extremely useful, and they tell you how you play something, right? But they're not necessarily tied to what the game is, because a game is an experience, and an experience is something that makes you feel something that's based on emotion. Mm-hmm. And that's what we care more about. We care more about finding that magic in games. And so we haven't really boiled down to specific genres. We more want to find these games that have something very, very specific when it comes to the emotional impact they have.
That's very cool. No, and I like that philosophy, right? Because you're going to get fans that are not necessarily just want to play roguelikes or some specific genre. They're going to be looking for some sort of emotional impact, emotional core to the game, which I think is good. I think it's you're going to be able to get different audiences and then bring them into new experiences, which is, I think, is yeah, a good thing for a publisher to do.
I mean, if I take myself as a, and you know what, you always have to have some sort of measuring stick, and the one that's closest to you is yourself, right? So if I take myself as a player, you know, I could name, you know, Faster Than Light, Hotline Miami, mm-hmm. Papers, Please. All three games are extremely different, right?
Right.
I enjoyed them all equally much, or you know, they're all amazing games and amazing experiences. So it didn't come down to the mechanics of the games individually. For me, it came down to the experience I had with them, and that was what made them all great.
Right. Yeah, and I think people who are looking for indie games like this are not necessarily tied to one particular. They, you know, a genre may attract them, but
yeah.
They're going to be people like I'm the same way. I'll play Rogue Legacy, and then I'll play, I don't know, whatever, some totally different game, FTL or something, right? And
right.
I'm interested in different genres because I'm looking for some sort of interesting hook rather than just another thing in the genre that I enjoy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Agreed. So when you come to a deal with these developers, what does the payment structure look like? Can I ask that? I don't, you know, you don't have to give any details about your specific contracts because they probably have confidentiality clauses, but are you funding the game throughout development, or are you just, how does that work?
Yeah, we fund the games. Okay. And we essentially do it, on a month by month basis. Basically, we fund the burn rate or the okay. developer burn, mm-hmm. And then we fund the the associated costs, marketing costs, all of right. that as well. We don't ask for any sort of milestone schedule or anything like that. So what we do is during the period where we're talking with the developers, we try to figure out, all right, what would be needed? Like, how much time do you think you need to finish this to a mm-hmm. A level that you think is you know, ready, right? The game mm-hmm. is ready. And then we talk about that and we figure out, all right, what's the burn rate needed for you to, you know, stay alive and not worry about life in general, right? Or, yes. or find, you know, what's needed to stay, you know, basically not have financial worries or fears. And then usually we try to make sure that there's no, like, people don't underestimate the time that's needed. Because I think, again, with the whole magic aspect, you need time to polish all the little details that actually make so much difference, right? So that's why if you go to our webpage, you know, until we have a set date mm-hmm. for launch, what you'll see there is, you know, it shifts when it's ready, right?
Yep.
So we try to make sure that's kind of the mentality. Then when it comes to the contract in general, we try to make it as fair as possible, and we built the contract we have from the ground up. So we didn't copy paste it from anywhere. We went through each and every single clause, and it's short. It's like, you know, maybe 10, 11 pages total, mm-hmm. with everything in there. Like so it's for a publishing contract that's very short. And you know, I come from a background of programming and systems architecture. So I like to work in a way where the variables are defined in the beginning, and then, you know, that things are readable and you can understand them. They're sure. well structured.
Right.
So that's also what we did with our contract. So you should be able to read it. A normal human being should be able to read it and understand.
I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah, that's how I try to write my contracts. I mean, sometimes you can't escape some legal stuff, but generally, yeah, just say it, say what you mean is the best way, I think, when you're drafting an agreement.
Exactly. And, and you know, it has to be like that. And,
absolutely.
And then we went through each and every single clause, and we made the justification for it, like to make sure that what we're doing is fair from both sides. And again, like I've been on the other side for a long, long time. So I still think like a guy that runs a development company. So so asking myself the is it fair question wasn't it wasn't that difficult actually. And it turns out that you can actually like, you know, you can reach an agreement where you can justify each and everything and everybody will feel fairly treated at the end. And that's kinda how we go about things. Because again, it has to be the basis of the relationship. If one party starts to feel that they're being exploited somehow or like that they are getting the you know, the worst end of the stick or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Again, it's just going to cause havoc down the road.
Yep. And also if this game is great, you want to continue that relationship, right? You don't want to poison that relationship by just to make a little bit more money or something. It just doesn't seem to make good business sense.
It should really be the way that if things are successful, then that's shared success, right? That everybody feels that they're sharing in that success.
Right.
How
big are these teams that you're working with, the developers?
So, so that's a good question. So Kingdom is two guys, one in Iceland and one in Amsterdam. And then Kathy Rain is essentially one guy, and then he uses contractors for some of the stuff he's doing, but it's one main person. So small teams.
Mm-hmm. And so as far as publisher versus developer, what are your roles, each of you? I mean, what are you taking over versus what are they doing?
I'm sure
most people know the answer to this, but just to kind of clarify how the role structure works.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we try to look at ourselves as kind of, you know, we're the supporting act. So we're there to make sure that things get done that aren't development, right? And we're very transparent. So everything we do is known to developers. Everything, like there are no black boxes. If we're thinking about something, we share it with the developers. We talk about it. If they have other ideas, we try to accommodate or figure things out. And you know, we make sure that they have input into the whole process. And then essentially, I mean, we do everything. Everything you need us to do. If you need to find a musician for your game, we'll do that. If you need, then we do the traditional things. We go to, you know, book the shows, book the floors, build the booths, make sure there's press, make sure like, you know, that you get noticed. We do everything in terms of the PR and marketing aspects. You know, of course we develop the relationship with the platform owners and make sure that they're there and they're tight and that the games have a good chance of actually coming out and get some love. But essentially, I mean, our mentality is very much like we feel that we're like it's one whole. It's a one, like, you know, these two teams, us and the developers, are integrated into a whole and everybody's going to the same place. And if there's anything we need to do, we'll figure out a way to do it. And that's kind of how we want to operate. And I think we keep saying, like, because one of the things I'm not keen on is pitching the publisher or trying to sell people on what we do and why we, you know, all of these things. Because that also creates an imbalance in the relationship. What I tell people is, you know, talk to the guys we work with or that know us and get them to tell you like what the value is or what we bring to the table, and that's much healthier. And if we're not doing a good job, then they'll tell you bad stories, and that's fine. That means that we're not doing a good job, and that you know, that's how the world should work.
Well, it speaks to the value of networking and having a professional and a cordial network with other people. I mean, when they talk to these people that know you, it sort of brings built-in trust, right? You've been vetted by these other people. And so Yeah, it's important. I mean, you can't sort of, you can't be a lone developer that never interacts with other developers. You really need to be part of this community, because word is either going to get around or word is not going to exist. And then, you know, how do people know they can trust you, that you know what you're doing?
Yeah. And I mean, that's actually one of the things we also try to do with, like, for instance, with the guys we're working with now is basically try to help them also just build a network, like mm-hmm. get connections to other cool developers, other people, like other publishers, even, like, you know, just help them build their own strong network that they can use, and, you know, people to talk to, people to hang out with during shows, because it builds their confidence as well. And, you know, that makes them feel better, which translates into a better game.
Better games. Yeah. In a creative industry like this, I think it's super important that you're always sort of bouncing ideas off of other developers.
Absolutely.
It's really going to make you better. Awesome. So do you handle QA and things like that, or is that generally handled on the developer side?
So again, that's something that happens more or less in the process. If the developer wants to handle it or wants to handle it up to a point, that's fine, right? That's totally fine. So we're more or less on the sidelines, where the developers want us to be on the sidelines. Then if they need help or want help, then we figure that out. If we do QA, we find people that are good at doing QA for that particular kind of game, and, you know, and we set it up, we make sure it happens, all of that. But it's really, again, it's the transparent process and the constant communication. So we don't go in and absorb certain things or aspects. It's always a conversation and what the developers want to have happen.
How does that work on a contractual level? Because, like, when I write contracts, I generally like to be as specific as possible about what the roles of each party are. When the roles are sort of moving and shifting, how do you get that in writing, I guess, in a way that doesn't lead to problems?
Right. I mean, it's not as tricky as it sounds. It's essentially what we have is, like, you know, if we cover costs that are outside of basically the development cost or marketing, that just goes into the, that goes into what we can reclaim from the revenues of the game, right?
Yeah.
And then it's just figuring out who does what. And if we have to contract QA, then we just do that. And it's essentially all boils down to the money, right?
Right. So what comes out of your gross revenue, right?
Yeah.
Okay. No, that's good. It sounds like a good way to do it. How about the final decisions? So who I would imagine as a publisher, you're going to take the final say on everything, right? Or am I wrong?
No. Yeah, again, it's a collaboration. It's a conversation. Okay. The creative, like, we don't go after, like, we don't ask for the IP. Mm-hmm. We don't ask for final cut rights. We are there to, you know, and that's why we're so picky, and we're very picky as well, because we want to find developers and games where we wholeheartedly believe in their vision, right, and their creative force, and they should be the drivers of that, and we should be the supporters of it. If they want our input and feedback, and of course, then we give it. And that's actually what happens every time, because we don't force it, but they start to ask for it, because that's how building these relationships work, right?
Yep.
But we don't dictate. We really don't dictate. And so it's a very collaborative effort. But the creatives should be the ones that decide where things go.
Very cool. Do you find that that's very different from what other publishers do? Or?
Yeah, I think so. I think it might be one of the things that kind of puts us apart a bit. And of course, I mean, you know, you can say that it increases the risk of what we're doing on our side and all that. But then again, our hope is that what being the being the ones that work in this way will attract more talented people that are doing more cool things, and that's we hope that's the upside of doing this.
Right. That's similar to movies where certain directors will have final cut of their movies, and that's a big deal, but it's because they put so much trust in those directors, right, to produce something amazing. And so I guess you have the same attitude. And I guess that's good. I mean, when you trust the developer to do what they do best and they trust you to do what you do, I think it's definitely a good relationship to have.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we essentially want, and that's what we're trying to build. Maybe it's extremely naive, and we'll fall flat on our noses, and it'll be horrible.
Right.
But I don't think so. I've been doing this whole businessy business stuff for a long time, and I'm a big fan of believing in people and trusting people, and I think it's worked out so much more often than not for me. So I feel comfortable.
I can understand that. Yeah, taking that. I mean, it seems like a small risk to take when the potential reward is going to be so much better.
Yeah. And, I think most smart people are ambitious and they want to succeed and they want to make something amazing. So give them the trust and they'll do it.
Right. And in a project like this, you both have the incentive, financial and otherwise, to create the best thing that you can, right? You're incentivized because you're going to get revenue and also because it's going to build your brand to market this thing the best you can, right? So there's no reason why you wouldn't want to do, a great job.
Exactly.
Yeah. Great. So you're based in Sweden, but your developers or some of them are out of the country. And then David, who I talked to on the last episode, is located, halfway around the world in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Do you find it difficult to work with a remote team?
Not at all. No, not at all. I think it's, I don't think we've hit any sort of wall or limitations or trouble because of that. I think in this day and age, with all the tools we have, you can balance these things. And again, we're not orthodox when it comes to like how the company actually functions. There's no 9-to-5 rule. There's no you have to be somewhere at some point. Like if there are meetings, of course, people are expected to call in. But we don't care if you're sitting in a coffee shop or out walking somewhere or whatever.
Exactly.
So it's all about, and I'm a firm believer in this, that it's all about what you create. It's about the input and output. It's not about ass in seats, right?
Yep.
I've
worked for places that were all about, the FaceTime, right? Making sure that they can see you at 8:30 in the morning and you're there. But now I'm completely remote and I work with developers all over the world. And they don't seem to have a problem with the fact that I'm generally not sitting in an office in San Francisco and I have no problem communicating with them. I think it's great.
Yeah, and I mean, it comes down to trust, right? I have complete trust and faith in both my colleagues and the guys that we're working with, and that's it.
Yeah. Are there any particular tools that you use when you're working with the remotely teams?
We use a slate of things, so everything from Slack to Gmail, Google Drive, Trello. The usual suspects when it comes to these kind of tools.
That's
Skype.
Great. Yeah. Yep. They're all I use all of them. So yeah, it's definitely I think they're pretty ubiquitous when it comes to working on teams like this. Great.
Mm-hmm.
Great. All right. Let's talk. This is sort of a legal podcast, so let's talk a little bit about trademarks, copyrights, things like that. Is that something that you've taken into account or that you're interested in protecting?
Sure. I mean, obviously it's a part of the whole thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We think about those things. And we do look into them for developers and try to make sure that things are in order as best as they can be.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing worse than starting to advertise your game and then finding out that, oh, there's already another game or something, a software package or something like that that has the same name, and you have to now backpedal and change the name or get some sort of coexistence agreement going or whatever. Yeah, it's not good. So I definitely would recommend to any developer, do the trademark clearance and all of that beforehand, before you even start. Before you name your game, definitely. I usually tell clients to come up with 5 or 10 names that are potential candidates, and then go from there. And we start knocking them out one by one, and figuring out which is the best one, the strongest trademark. Mm. But that's my opinion of it, anyway. I don't know. But most of the time, a lot of times, clients will come to me and they're like, "Yeah, we got this name, and this is it, and we've already been marketing it." And I say, "Okay, so maybe it's not the strongest name, but."
Yeah,
we work with what we can.
Well, I mean, again, that's a little bit of our philosophy as well. We give advice and we tell people about the potential risks and all of that. But ultimately, if the developers want to go with a certain name and we feel there's any way to make it work, then we do that.
Sure.
Because you know there's power in names as well, and like. You know, and I totally get that. I've been on the other side again on that. You've created something, and in your head it has this name, and from that name comes a part of the whole thing for you, right? So it becomes like this integrated part of the creation, and it almost feels like, you know, when someone says you have to change the name, it almost feels like someone's telling you like you have to rename your baby,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. People definitely don't want a lawyer telling them that.
I get it. No. I know from experience that's the last thing they want to hear is that, no, you need to change your name. You're not going to.
Yeah.
They're not going to like to hear that. Yeah. All right. Well, we are coming to the time limit for the show. I guess that wraps it up, unless you have anything else you wanted to address, Jonas.
Well, that was a good question. Yeah. No, I mean... Well, I definitely urge people to check out Kingdom when it goes live. It's set to go live October 21st, which is actually a pretty cool date if you're a geek like me, because it's if especially if you're an old geek like me, because if you remember the Back to the Future movies, that date has a very specific meaning.
Sure.
So
this is the day.
October 21st, 2015, man. That's the day.
The release of Jaws 19 and Kingdom, I think. Awesome. Yeah. So, all right. And also, well, okay. Give me one tip. Or a developer that's looking for a publisher, what is the most important thing they should be doing?
The most important thing they should be doing is thinking about the end result of what they're creating. So I know it's very, very easy to get bogged down in the details and all of that, but think about the end result. What do you want to achieve with what you're doing, and how do you best achieve that? And find someone, if you think you need help or want help to maximize the impact or make it a better game, whatever it is. Make sure you find people that you feel comfortable working with over a long period of time, and that you trust, and that you feel have the same attitude and mentality that you do.
Excellent advice. Okay. Where can we find you?
So essentially rawfury.com, the homepage. Mm-hmm. You can send, people can send us email at rebelrebel@rawfury.com. Or just jonas@rawfury.com, and that'll drop into my inbox.
Perfect. Yeah. All right. You can find me at gamelawyerblog.com. You can read more about the legal aspects of game development there in my blog. And make sure to go on iTunes and review us. Just give us 5 stars, and you don't have to bother with the text, believe me. I've also launched a Patreon campaign to improve the show, like covering the cost of hosting, renting space to record from, as well as getting this turned into a video podcast and buying equipment for that. So check that out at patreon.com/legalmoves to help make the show bigger and better. And I will see you on the next episode of Legal Moves.